Remember to look for WKAR's Current State. Broadcasting this Saturday from downtown Lansing. We hope you can join us next to the Grand River in Adado Riverfront Park. We couldn't say no to the chance to take the show to a fish rodeo. So we consider this a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. So we will be there from 11 to 1 with live music and guests. And the point is to celebrate water. The point is to celebrate the Grand River and really all of Michigan waterways. In fact, the official slogan of the Fish Rodeo is a celebration of Michigan waterways and a chance to be a little weird. So there you go. The Grand American Fish Rodeo actually begins tomorrow. Saturday is actually its final day. So Thursday, Friday, Saturday in Riverfront Park. If you'd like to learn more, GrandAmericanFishRodeo.com. GrandAmericanFishRodeo.com. If you're in the neighborhood, stop by and see us Saturday, 11 till 1. Later on in the program, it's Neighbors in Action. We check in. We learn more about the East Lansing-based Hometown Housing Partnership. This is an organization that promotes home ownership and offers financial assistance to home buyers. We'll talk World Cup with MSU's soccer scholar Peter Allegi. And there's an auction at the Silver Dome today. They're literally auctioning off parts of the Silver Dome today. And Scott Pohl has looked into that, and he joins us in just a few minutes. At the top of our program, Michigan's outdated approach to youth justice does little to rehabilitate children, protect public safety, or wisely invest taxpayer dollars. Those are among the provocative conclusions of a new report co-authored by our next guest. The Lansing-based Michigan Council on Crime and Delinquency has looked at a decade's worth of juvenile justice data. It found that more than 20,000 Michigan young people were placed on adult probation, detained in jail, or imprisoned for an offense committed when they were younger than 18 years of age. According to the study, a majority of those charges involved nonviolent offenses that did not include a weapon. It goes on to make a series of recommendations. And to talk more about the report and what it means, Current State welcomes Michelle Wiemhoff, Associate Director of the Michigan Council on Crime and Delinquency. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Mark. Thank you for having me.
Sure, you're welcome. It's great to have you here. Let's go into your study. Your report points out that Michigan is one of 10 states that automatically prosecute 17-year-olds as adults, and it suggests that society pays a price. How exactly?
Absolutely. So in Michigan, it's very interesting. We actually are one of 10 states that prosecutes 17-year-olds as adults. It's a law that's been on the books since 1907, so for over 100 years, basically since our juvenile justice system was created. But of course, now we have far more research on what the best practices are for working with kids, yet we're still using this antiquated law. And really, over the time, over this period of time, there has been no analysis as to what the impact is. You know, are there better ways that we could be serving this youthful population? And in our report, we actually uncovered that this 17-year-old population, not only are the majority of them committing nonviolent offenses, but they also have very serious backgrounds, with over almost half of them have drug abuse issues, a quarter have alcohol abuse issues, almost over 20% have mental health needs prior to entering prison. So we're talking about a very fragile population that would really benefit from treatment services. Unfortunately, the 17-year-old population is prohibited from accessing those rehabilitative services that are only available in juvenile courts because they're being processed as adults.
You're okay with 18-year-olds being subjected to the adult? I mean, does something dramatic happen at the age of 18?
Well, I think that there certainly is research that shows that physiologically adolescents develop well into their early 20s. But the state law on many other regulations around voting, signing a contract, for example, you have to be 18-year-old. Mm-hmm. The norm is that, you know, we consider 18-year-olds to be adults. That's something that's established in Michigan state law, as well as federal guidelines. And the U.S. Supreme Court and the United Nations have established the age of 18 specifically in regards to prosecuting youth as adults.
So there's something particularly egregious in your view as far as subjecting somebody under the age of 18 to an adult standard, certainly with regard to the legal system.
Yes.
And what have you.
We know so much more now mm-hmm. about how teens are developing, which has allowed researchers to really create the most effective evidence-based programs for treating delinquency. In the long term, that's these highly effective programs have been able to reduce crime. Unfortunately, what we see when youth enter the adult criminal justice system is that they're subjected to adult probation, they're put into jail, they're put into prison. These systems are not designed around the developmental needs of youth. And as a result, we see kids languishing, not advancing in their education, not receiving the appropriate treatment that they mm-hmm. need. You know, young people who enter the prison system are on average about 2 grade levels behind their peers. And instead of really investing in services that will ultimately help them become more productive adults, we actually are putting them in situations that can be quite harmful.
We're talking with Michelle Wiemhoff of the Michigan Council on Crime and Delinquency. Their latest report suggests that the way we approach juvenile justice in Michigan is seriously outdated, and they go on to make a series of recommendations for reform. You alluded to a 1907 law, which goes further back into history than I was expecting, but in particular, something happened in the 90s as well. You assert that a series of reforms from the 90s really need some review. Too many juvenile offenses that require an adult sentence. What happened in the 90s?
So basically, throughout the 80s, we did see an increase in crime across the country. So in the late 80s and the mid-90s, Michigan sort of joined this trend to get tough on crime.
Wasn't that a lot of drug and gang related activity in the 80s? That's what I've heard many times.
Yes, in the 80s. Okay. And there was an increase in violent crime for a period of time. But beginning in the early 90s, we actually started seeing a decline, a decrease in violent crime across the country, which also happened in Michigan. And that decline has continued. We're now at a 30-year low in violent crime. Unfortunately, that didn't stop the rhetoric and the frenzy of people thinking that we suddenly had this new generation of very violent youth. It wasn't true. It wasn't founded. But as a result, almost every state in the country did change their laws to be harsher on youth. Mm-hmm. Michigan actually self-proclaimed as having the harshest laws in the nation. And as part of that bill package, we expanded the discretion that prosecutors had to transfer youth into the adult system. We expanded the number of offenses for which youth could be tried as adults. We actually eliminated the lower age so that now a youth of any age can be convicted as adult in the state of Michigan.
Mm. Any response to your report from law enforcement? I mean, it just came out, but I'm curious. It was a pretty provocative report. Any response from law enforcement, prosecutors? The Attorney General?
As part of the research for this report, in addition to analyzing data from the Department of Corrections and the courts, we also interviewed over 50 stakeholders around the state. And that included a broad range of perspectives, including judges, prosecutors, the Department of Corrections, and really wanted to make sure that in our report, we tried to take a moderate view and include every perspective. We certainly understand that there are going to be some people who disagree with our recommendations, but our purpose in doing this report was to start that dialogue. And ultimately, I think a lot of the policies that have been implemented since the 90s really came out of a place of emotion and fear. And it's really time for us to look at what is the data telling us, what is the research telling us about best practices for working with kids. And from that much more scientific place, we can make really sound policy decisions that really are targeted at reducing crime.
Tell us a little bit more about that. It sounds like you've looked into that as well. First of all, what happens to young people who are subjected to the adult system arguably too early in age?
Yeah. So basically what we see is that when young people enter jails or prisons, that they tend to be far more disruptive than either adults who are in prison or youth who are in juvenile justice facilities.
More disruptive.
More disruptive. For a number of reasons, of course. Developmentally, it's a very traumatic experience to be in prison. And also, a lot of these youth do have mental health needs that manifest in behavioral issues. Once they enter prison, that type of misconduct can actually result in citations, which can lead to segregation of youth, which is one of the most traumatizing experiences that any human can endure. In addition to that, we also became aware through our research of a lawsuit against the Michigan Department of Corrections alleging sexual victimization, physical victimization of youth in the adult criminal justice system. And, you know, it really raised a lot of concerns around the type of treatment that youth are receiving.
One of your colleagues at MCCD, Kristen Staley, told our Capitol Bureau Chief, Rick Pluta, that conservatives across the nation are increasingly leading the kinds of reforms that you support. So it's easy enough to assume that conservatives led the reforms of the 90s and have led some of these these efforts to toughen the laws. From your perspective, is that happening here in Michigan? Are conservatives at the forefront of an attempt to reform this situation?
Yes, I would say so. I mean, I think justice reform is an issue that's a priority on both sides of the aisle. Everyone wants, ultimately, to have safe communities. I mean, that's, in fact, why we wrote this report. Our goal really is to help improve public safety. But at the end of the day, we've seen a shift, particularly among conservative politicians, who are recognizing that it's not only the high costs of safety and well-being of children, it's not only that we're looking at safety of communities, but
financial
we're also looking
cost.
At, incredibly high financial costs that really could be invested towards effective programming that works. In Michigan, the average cost of incarcerating someone is about $34,000 a year, and on average, young people stay for about 4 years. But they can have much longer sentences. A good portion of them do have sentences that are 15, 20 years, or even longer. We still have life without the possibility of parole for youth under the age of 18. Mm. So, and it's not only the financial cost of incarceration that we are concerned about. We also need to consider that the majority of young people are going to exit the prison system within 5 years. And suddenly they'll be in their early 20s, maybe 30, and have significant barriers because of their conviction to finding a house, continuing their education, securing stable employment, which of course translates into, a reduction in state tax revenue and the possibility of relying upon public benefits. And the research actually found that a young person that has an adult conviction has a 40% lower lifetime earning than someone who does not have a conviction.
Michigan Senator Rick Jones, the Republican chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, visited us yesterday, and I asked him to comment on your report. It was all over the papers yesterday, and I figured it was appropriate to ask. I mean, Rick Jones is former sheriff of Eaton County, and I asked him about what he thought about easing these sentencing laws. Here is how he responded yesterday.
As a whole, I want to see teens put into rehab, rehabilitation, make them productive children. But we have to be aware that we have some teens that are so psychologically damaged, you would never want them in society again. Two quick examples. We had one teen who murdered a man, he said, because he wanted to see what it felt like.
Now, Senator Jones went on to describe how the body was mutilated. We'll spare the gruesome details. But when you're confronted with a really gruesome example of serious pre-18-year-old crime, it does happen some percentage of the time. How do you respond?
Well, unfortunately, violent crime does happen, and it's tragic. And we want to first and foremost make sure that we're not discounting the real pain and suffering experienced by victims. But we need to be very careful that we are not creating these broad sweeping laws that are based on emotion and fear. And really, based on the most rare and exceptional of cases, we now have a very robust data and research platform that we can go to that shows us which populations to target and the most effective interventions to use. And what we see in our data is that the majority of young people coming into the adult system have committed nonviolent offenses, have not used a weapon, and will be out within 5 years. So additionally, the national research shows that youth who are exiting adult prison are 34% more likely to reoffend sooner, and reoffend more violently than youth who are processed in the juvenile justice system. So it really raises the question, are the policies that we have in place currently actually designed to protect the public, or are they in fact creating conditions that may actually increase crime and as a result create more victims? And we certainly don't want that to happen. And I would imagine that Senator Jones would agree on that point.
Do you? There are a number of stakeholders in this larger discussion. Do you expect crime victims organizations, crime victims groups, families of crime victims to be receptive to your report, or do you expect resistance generally from them?
Well, actually, one of the recommendations in the report is to engage victims and their families in this dialogue, as well as families who have incarcerated loved ones. I think increasingly we're having these policy conversations with people who are disconnected from the true impact. Mm-hmm. And our goal is to make sure that community members really have an active voice and that victims are upfront and part of that conversation. So we absolutely would welcome victims and victim advocacy groups to review this information and help develop really sound recommendations that are designed to, again, reduce crime. Because at the end of the day, I'm sure that that is a mutual goal that we both have.
You can learn all about the Michigan Council on Crime and Delinquency's latest study, which just became public yesterday. Michelle, remind everybody of your website so people can go look at that if they wish.
You can find all the report materials at www.miccd.org.
miccd.org. We want to thank you for your time, and we'll continue to keep an eye on this. Michelle Wiemhoff is Associate Director of the Michigan Council on Crime and Delinquency. Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Pontiac Silver Dome hosted the Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, The Who, The Pope. You weren't expecting The Pope right after The Who, were you? WrestleMania, a Super Bowl, and of course the Detroit Lions and the Detroit Pistons. Largely unused since the Lions moved back to downtown Detroit, the Silver Dome was sold in 2009 to the Triple Investment Group for about $500,000. And you may have seen photos recently of the tattered roof that's collapsed inside the building. Now, its assets are going up for auction with lots of interested sports fans and business community members as well. Current State Scott Pohl is here with more. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mark. Were you ever at the Silver Dome?
I have been to Silver Dome a few times, sure.
I saw a couple of Lions games there. I saw The Who there,
nice.
Led Zeppelin.
Nice.
I saw the Bee Gees at the height of their popularity in the Silver Dome.
Okay, yeah.
So it was a real iconic fixture on the Michigan landscape
Without a doubt.
Well, the Silver Dome auction was postponed a few weeks ago, but now it's getting underway today. I recently talked with Rick Montgomery, who's owner of RJM Auctioneers in Plymouth, Michigan, who says this is one of the biggest projects he's ever worked on.
It is a very large project. Tagging, cataloging, and photographing, and we're in the somewhere in between 3,000 and 4,000 items that'll be in the sale. But yeah, it ranks right up there in our top five largest projects that we've done.
You mentioned several thousand items. I think of 80,000 seats in the Silver Dome that people might want to buy. Where do the seats fit in?
I'm not even counting those. Those are being privately sold. We've been selling them for about a month. And that's all private sales online, of course, on our website, and at various prices starting at $100. You can go on SilverDomeSeats.com, and you can see all the variety of choices you can have for buying seats. Those are not included in the auction. Everything else is in the auction, and that's a separate entity in itself. So, no, I'm not counting the 80,000 seats.
I do want to throw in one last piece of information about the seats, though, in that I've heard that every seat that's numbered 20 has a higher price because people will associate that with the number 20 that Barry Sanders wore.
That's correct, and there's a limited number of those seats.
All right, now, 4,000 items. What are those items if we're not talking about seats? What sorts of things are we talking about?
Well, you know, there were 93 concessioners there, and each of them had a section of the facility where they have a backroom kitchen and the front counter with the pretzel machines or the hot dog stuff and cotton candy machines and stainless steel sinks, pizza ovens. All of that's still intact. We go in the building maintenance equipment as far as backup generation, lighting, signage everywhere, aisle signs. There's one sign that's lot number one in our sale that says, "Welcome to the home of Super Bowl 16." A lot of different things like that. You have office equipment, lift trucks, all the different banners, the things that used to be there upstairs. They're in the main event, it's a complete restaurant, is still intact. So all of those, all of that assets are still there. All the suites, they have like new sofas in them and all the different seating in the suites. So there's plenty of stuff to bid on. In fact, there's the Pistons scoreboard is still there. I'm not sure what anyone would do with it. It's quite large, but it's still there and it'll be in the auction.
One of the items I saw listed is a Zamboni turf machine, which I don't quite get. I associate a Zamboni with the ice surface of a hockey rink.
Yeah, Zamboni is a brand name, and they certainly make ice arena equipment. I think they're most popular for that. But this is a machine that actually rolls up the turf into rolls so that it can be put away if they want to do something else on the field, like a truck pole or something like that. They remove the turf, and then it rolls it back out.
It seems to me that we have two different kinds of items here, some functional for perhaps a business, maybe a restaurant looking to upgrade their kitchen, maybe some of the mobile kitchen food service operations you're seeing these days, and then there's more memorabilia-type materials, too.
Absolutely. There's a good mix, and the majority of it is going to be for the business person, but there's plenty of things to take home as collectible.
So tell me how the auction is actually going to be conducted.
It's a timed event, and if you watch the auction, it'll tell you how many minutes are left for each item. If somebody bids in the last 3 to 5 minutes on an item, it will extend that particular item out for another 5 more minutes, so the other bidder has a chance to come back. So there's no sniping on it.
Will there ever be a time where there is, say, someone with a gavel and an auctioneer and people milling around trying to bid on things live, or is it strictly online?
Strictly online.
I've read that every item starts at $5, and anything that doesn't get at least $5 is going to be thrown out. Can you tell me about what kind of arrangements you've made for throwing out things that aren't bought?
We've made no arrangements for throwing out. They will be abandoned and left at the facility.
Ah, so the owner of the property will need to deal with anything that isn't sold.
That's correct.
How will people be able to collect the items that they've placed the winning bid for?
Well, there's several different ways. They can show up by appointment at the dome, and we will escort them to grab their items and escort them right out. They can hire an on-site company that's independent from us, L&J Removal. And they'll be listed on our website that will actually go into the facility, gather all the items, and especially if it requires equipment to move them, and bring them out to their vehicles. Or they can hire another firm that will do the shipping, come in and get it and do the shipping. And all those people are listed on our website.
Well, Rick Montgomery, owner of RJM Auctioneers of Plymouth, Michigan, conducting the auction of items left over at the Pontiac Silverdome. A couple of very busy weeks ahead for you. Thank you for taking a little time to talk with me today.
Well, you're welcome, Scott, and thanks for letting us do it.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
We'll point out the Lansing State Journal is reporting today that the head of the Lansing Board of Water and Light, Peter Lark, says the utility will adopt more than 100 recommendations outlined in the Independent Community Review Team's report. General Manager Peter Lark spoke to members of the BWL's Board of Commissioners yesterday. He said the organizational problems that plagued the utility at the time of last December's historic ice storm were much deeper than he initially acknowledged. Lark says implementing the recommendations is going to be costly, though, and that ratepayers should expect to see cost increases. It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. We're glad you're along today. Once every 4 years, hundreds of millions of soccer fans get swept up in the excitement of the World Cup. The month-long spectacle begins play tomorrow in Brazil. The event's not just about sport, though. It's also an exercise in politics and international relations, particularly for the host country, which could see both positive and negative side effects from hosting the game. Dr. Peter Alleggi is Michigan State University's resident expert on the World Cup. He's a professor in the Department of History and author of several books which explore the social and political side of soccer, including Africa's World Cup, Critical Reflections on Play, Patriotism, Spectatorship, and Space. Dr. Alleggi, welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
To understand the political aspects of the World Cup, I guess we first have to really understand FIFA. Could you give us an abridged version of what FIFA is all about?
FIFA is not just a video game. It is the world governing body of soccer. And it is a nonprofit international NGO based in Zurich, Switzerland, and it owns the World Cup, from which it accumulates about 90%+ of its revenue.
Mm-hmm. But officially a nonprofit.
Officially a nonprofit.
So during the last World Cup in South Africa, or this year's in Brazil, what are the obligations of the host country to FIFA?
Well, the main obligations is to deliver a tournament that satisfies the very exacting demands and requirements of FIFA. And the most important thing, of course, is to provide world-class stadiums in which the games will take place, the transportation and telecommunication infrastructure, and everything that goes with organizing the tournament. These are all spelled out in minute detail in legal agreements that the host nation has to sign with FIFA. And these are obviously binding. And as I said, these are very exacting, and it's a costly arrangement for the host nations, but it's a very remunerative one, a profitable one for FIFA.
What does FIFA gain?
Well, in the last World Cup in South Africa in 2010, according to FIFA's own financial statements, the organization earned over $2.3 billion U.S. in profit, tax-free.
But there are people who argue that the financial gains from the event are not fairly distributed. I take it that is an ongoing debate.
There's no question that the agreement is unequal in terms of the hosting arrangements. FIFA walks away with all these tax-free profits, some of which are reinvested in the game, but quite a bit of those profits end up simply in their bank accounts. But for the host nations, it's usually a financial loss. In South Africa's case, you know, the conservative estimate of the expenses that the country incurred in were about 7 billion U.S., right? So very few countries have been able to break even, let alone make a small profit from hosting the World Cup. So really what they're doing is paying for a massive global advertising campaign for their countries.
But in the end, there is a fair amount of competition to host the World Cup. Is in the end, despite the financial losses, is it arguable that it's worth it, or is there a consensus that it's not?
Well, I'm not sure about a consensus, but what seems to be happening is that politicians around the world and their corporate partners seem to agree that the emotional benefits that a country gets from these tournaments are worth the expense. And by that, I mean both the political gains that come out of it, particularly national unity, strengthened national pride and patriotism. You know, those are quite valuable. Selling the country to tourists and foreign investors is seen as an incredibly worthwhile pursuit. But I think there's also an emerging consensus that, yeah, financially, these are not going to work out. Mm. And in Brazil, we're starting to see already, starting last year, that citizens are quite upset with this kind of an arrangement.
There are other challenges facing the host countries. During the last World Cup in South Africa, there were special measure acts passed, which in some ways actually, I'm told, actually weakened the host country's sovereignty during the month of the World Cup in order to protect FIFA's interest. Can you tell us more about that?
So part of the host nation agreements that FIFA makes the host nation sign is the requirement that laws be passed to protect FIFA's financial interests. And these include the special World Cup laws. In South Africa, as you said, those Special Measures Act were passed. And what those do primarily is they set up these kind of extraterritorial zones for FIFA within about a mile and a half from the venues of the World Cup matches. And within those zones, right, your national sovereignty is temporarily surrendered to this transnational organization called FIFA, as well as the constitutional rights of the citizens of the host nation are surrendered. In the case of South Africa, you know, one thinks of a country where they struggled so hard and sacrificed so much for almost 50 years to defeat apartheid, to bring about freedom and democracy. And for 30 days, they gave up those hard-earned rights in order to have a successful and peaceful FIFA World Cup. Yeah. And so that the corporations that sponsor it, right, have their business interests protected.
Extraordinary. Have similar measures been passed in Brazil for this year's World Cup, similar to what we just talked about in South Africa?
Yes, in Brazil, it's called the General Law of the World Cup. And not only are these same exclusion zones set up around the venues and in certain cities around Brazil, but also there are special tribunals in place so that violations, whether they be fans misbehaving or whether it's ambush marketing where particular sponsors are trying to insinuate themselves into the competition zone, even though they're not official partners, they are processed more quickly than they would otherwise be in the special tribunal and dealt with by the judicial system in Brazil. So, very much the same kinds of laws have been passed in the case of Brazil. And what I find really concerning here is not so much the attention paid to crowd safety, which of course, you know, is paramount, but also how this provides a bit of an excuse for future events in which the constitutional rights of people could be temporarily suspended and the national sovereignty of a particular country given up.
Have there been serious rights violations, in your view, due to these kinds of laws so far, or are you more concerned about the future?
Well, in the case of South Africa, there weren't any large-scale violations, but there were some worrying instances. For example, a colleague of mine when I was teaching as a Fulbright scholar at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, he was distributing pamphlets at a FIFA fan park where games are screened on a large screen for people who can't get or don't want to go to the games at the stadium. And he was arrested because the police said that in the FIFA zone, he had no free speech rights. Right. So that did happen. Mm-hmm. And in the Brazilian case, some of the violations really that are more egregious have to do with the forced evictions of poor people from the favelas, the poor neighborhoods in and around the stadiums and other venues.
Our guest is Dr. Peter Alleggi, who's on the faculty here at Michigan State University and who is an expert and written several books about soccer and the World Cup. As I'm sure many have seen in the news, there have been street protests over the event in Brazil against FIFA. Are protests like this typical during a World Cup in the host country?
Not really typical, no. I think they're increasing, though, because of the fact that so much public money, taxpayer money, is being spent to host these essentially corporate sports spectacles. So, no, they're not typical, although they have happened in the past. And in some cases, the human rights violations were quite horrible. The most famous, perhaps, is that in 1968 in Mexico City, we're on the eve of those famous or perhaps infamous Olympics, right? Hundreds of people were shot in one of the main squares in Mexico City, and the blood had just been wiped off the plaza when the athletes started arriving. Mm.
What impact do you think this tension will have on the event in Brazil overall?
That's hard to say. I think, you know, last night, I believe it was, the president of Brazil, Rousseff, went on TV and gave a big primetime speech defending the Brazil's hosting of the World Cup. And it seemed to me that a lot is going to hinge on the performance of the Brazilian team. In other words, if Brazil ends up winning their sixth World Cup, then I think the legacy of this tournament is going to be perceived as a positive one, and there's going to be massive celebration in the way that only Brazilians know how to celebrate, with lots of dancing and partying. But if Brazil does not win, I think there's a real risk for a political uprising in Brazil.
Really? You alluded to the dislocation of a lot of poor people to make way for the facilities in Brazil for this year's World Cup. Ironically, at such large world events in the past, a lot of these facilities sometimes become ruins afterwards. Is that the case with the World Cup as well? Can you point to facilities that are in ruins now?
Certainly, there's evidence from past World Cups that happened. In South Korea, for instance, in 2002, several of the stadiums that hosted World Cup games became so-called white elephants, and a couple of them have been demolished already. The South Koreans decided to cut their losses, and rather than continue to maintain facilities that weren't being used, they got rid of them. In South Africa, in 2010, they built five brand new stadiums. They refurbished five. Only two of the 10 stadiums used in South Africa in 2010 are used regularly, week in and week out, by professional soccer teams in that country. In Brazil, there are at least four venues that are at serious risk of becoming white elephants, including, you know, stadiums built in Amazonia, like the one in Manaus, where the local amateur team or semi-professional team only draws about 1,000, 2,000 people a game. And now they have a 42,000-seat stadium that we know is not going to be sustainable. The same in the city of Natal, in Cuiabá, and even in the capital, Brasilia, where the local team draws very few spectators, and they have a massive, you know, stadium of 70,000 seats, where, you know, they spent hundreds of millions of dollars on this beautiful facility that is in that curvaceous modernist style, as David Goldblatt puts it, of the city of Brasilia that Oscar Niemeyer, the famous architect, constructed, right? And it's just going to sit there empty. And it's really quite predictable and therefore hard to explain, including to the citizens of Brazil.
Is there any credible discussion within FIFA to address reforms, to launch reforms, to address any of these issues that we've been talking about?
The key word there is credible.
So they do acknowledge it up to a point that reforms are necessary, but they're not serious?
I don't think so. I think what kind of reform they talk about is really a public relations exercise. And they're very good at that. They're extremely sophisticated. And as you and I are speaking here to this morning, FIFA is holding its Congress in Brazil. It's being streamed live. So if listeners want to go and see how FIFA operates, just go to their website, FIFA.com, and you can watch the proceedings. And it's really not an institution that's going to change from within, although the president, Sepp Blatter, has an opponent for next year's presidential elections who, Jérôme Champagne, a former French diplomat and former ally of Blatter, who is actively campaigning on a reformist platform. But if you look at the nitty-gritty of that reformist agenda, it's hard to see how it's going to be really transformational.
Very interesting. This was just on the BBC World News last night, the challenge that the current president of FIFA is undergoing as a result of this. It's at least getting more publicity the controversy. Globally, Brazil's national identity is so tied up with football, as you alluded to a minute ago. Of the eight countries who have won the World Cup, Brazil has the most wins. How might Brazil's national identity be impacted by the games?
In a brand new book entitled The Country of Football, which is how most of the world refers to soccer, of course, the historian Roger Kittleson makes a really interesting argument about how this World Cup is trying to forge a new kind of Brazilian identity. And he links it very closely to two things. One, he links it to this idea of tropical modernity, which I find quite appealing, right? This country that is part of the BRICS club, along with
Brazil, Russia, India, China.
And South Africa.
In South Africa, BRICS, right.
And, you know, putting forth a strikingly different image of the global South, or at least the countries outside of the traditional, you know, great powers club, a country that combines the cultural vibrancy that one often finds in the global South with all of the technological and business sophistication of that we associate with modernity. The other thing that the Brazilians apparently are trying to do, according to Kittleson, is to emphasize the kind of inclusive nature of Brazilian society and culture, a sense of Brazilianness that is accepting of all its people, whether they are of white or mixed race or black background, or whether they are rich or poor, what have you, a kind of rainbow nationalism that, to my mind, reminded me a lot of what South Africa tried to do in 2010 to bring back that spirit of Nelson Mandela, that spirit of reconciliation and progress and healing.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Peter Alleghi is a Michigan State University resident expert on the World Cup. Beyond his many books on football, he also runs the blog Football is Coming Home. Dr. Alleghi, thanks.
Thank you.
It's Wednesday, and that means it's time for Current State's Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today, we feature the Hometown Housing Partnership, which is an East Lansing-based organization that promotes home ownership and offers financial assistance to home buyers. Mickey Drosty is the executive director of the Hometown Housing Partnership. Mickey, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And how long have you been around, first of all, and what are your main goals?
The Hometown Housing Partnership was formed about 22 years ago by a group of East Lansing residents who were interested in increasing the number of homeowner-occupied homes in some of the core neighborhoods that had seen a large increase in rental housing. Mm-hmm. So they partnered with, at the time, the City of East Lansing to help determine what rental restrictions might look like, as well as providing programs that would increase the number of people that would be purchasing homes in East Lansing.
Mm-hmm. And how many people have you helped over the years?
In those 22 years, we're working, I think, on about families number 30 and through 130 through 135 right now. We have a couple of houses under construction and homeownership.
And tell us about the people that you serve. Typically, what are their circumstances? These are people who want to own a home.
The one consistent factor between all of the people that we serve is that they have a huge desire to become a homeowner in East Lansing and are of the belief that they can't do so. A lot of times East Lansing is outside of people's economic ability, and our programs provide to them some of the down payment assistance and gap financing that makes homeownership in East Lansing affordable where it otherwise might not be.
I'm curious how the housing crisis might have played into this, though, because values obviously went down everywhere there for a while. They have since rebounded. Was the housing crisis and the depression in housing values, was that an opportunity for you to get more people into homes, or how did that play out?
Well, during the heart of the crisis, we did very little production because lenders were a little nervous about any and all financing types that weren't your standard 20% down mortgages.
So the lower prices did not compensate for the new challenges in lining up financing.
True. That said, the recovery phase has been fabulous for our programs because
Great.
The prices have remained, or at least started at a place where more people were able to purchase homes at the prices that were on the market. And combined with our programming, we did a lot of work over the last couple of years.
Very encouraging. Our guest is Mickey Drosty. Mickey's the executive director of the Hometown Housing Partnership based in East Lansing. One of the programs you offer, Mickey, is your down payment assistance program. How does that work?
Well, the down payment assistance program, we have funding from a number of different sources, the City of East Lansing, Michigan State Housing Development Authority, and we have some combined down payments from employers that actually offer assistance to their employees locally as well. The funds can be used for a variety of things. If a buyer comes in and doesn't have the down payment amount that their lender requires for their first mortgage, we can assist them with some of the down payment as well as some of the closing costs, which get fairly expensive in purchasing a home as well.
Mm-hmm.
The area in which we use the program in East Lansing more often than not is as a gap financing tool. If a buyer, for instance, comes in and can afford a $100,000 mortgage but finds a house for $110,000 but can't quite get the mortgage for that amount, we can use some of our down payment assistance funds as gap financing for that $10,000 that they can't get in the mortgage, as well as then the down payment and closing costs.
In your work at the Housing Partnership over the last few years, can you think of an interaction that's really memorable for you that really kind of captures why you do what you do?
We've had some really fabulous buyers I've been with the organization 2 years. I can say for sure right now we are in the process of building a home for a lady who has been a renter in East Lansing for about 17 years, was convinced that she could not become a homeowner because she could not afford it, has 3 sons in the school district, loves the school district, wants to stay. Her landlord increased her rent substantially. She decided that if she was going to pay that much, she was going to figure out how to become a homeowner, and came to us saying, help me, I really want to own a home in East Lansing, don't want to move my kids out of the school system.
Mm-hmm.
We are currently building her a house between what she could afford in a mortgage and what we offered in down payment assistance and what she had saved in hopes that someday she would become a homeowner.
Is that a new thing for you to actually build a house? Or have you done that before?
It's a fairly recent program. A couple of years ago, we got some funding from the state that would allow us to buy either vacant lots or homes in East Lansing that we could fix up or do new construction, sell them for the appraised value. But because we can offer the down payment assistance, which then becomes gap financing, it becomes considerably more affordable. In her case, her sales price on her home is about $135,000. She could afford a $100,000 mortgage.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
She had saved some money, and we offered $25,000 in gap financing to bring that mortgage down to a place where it was affordable for her.
Interesting. You've alluded to all kinds of different funding sources. How is the organization itself funded?
The program funding that comes to us often comes with some administrative dollars as well. So as we produce housing and or assist clients,
Some of that
actually helps pay for, keeping the lights on and having a 1.5 person staff.
Yeah.
Though much of what we do is still done with volunteers.
Okay, so volunteers do play a role in your organization. How many do you have?
The volunteers that spend the most time and offer the most assistance for us are our fabulous board. We have a board of 13, two-thirds of which reside in the neighborhoods in which we work, and then we have some at-large members that bring some great talent to the table as well. Other volunteer opportunities are we do promotions at open houses and events and some landscaping in the houses that we work on. So we use volunteers for those services as well.
Very interesting. You also offer funds for rehabilitating homes. What types of projects does that include?
The City of East Lansing has granted some funds to us that will assist existing homeowners in East Lansing that are income qualified that need work on a home that they are currently living in that look like code compliance issues or energy efficiency improvements or systems that a roof or a heating system or something like that that needs to be replaced that they don't have the funds themselves to do.
Which East Lansing neighborhoods do you focus on? You've alluded a couple of times to focusing on a few.
Yeah, the core kind of downtown neighborhoods that are our focus areas include Red Cedar neighborhood, Central and Chesterfield neighborhood, Bailey neighborhood, and Southeast Marble.
And if you want to, if you want people to reach out and learn more about what services you offer, where can they go?
They should call our office at 517-332-4663, or we've just recently updated our website, so it actually has some pretty good information and explanations about our program, which is hometownhousing.org.
332-4663. Lots of exciting stuff going on in your organization. It's been a pleasure to learn about it.
Thank you, Mark.
Mickey Drosty, Executive Director of the Hometown Housing Partnership. We could always use more nominations, and we know there are people and organizations out there doing excellent work. We need to find out about them, though. Please help us out and tweet us suggestions at KAR Current State or send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work that they do. That's our program for today. Coming up Thursday on Current State, we'll learn about a Michigan man's quest to have a beer with mogul Richard Branson. A beer with Branson, and we'll look ahead to the Grand American Fish Rodeo. That and more tomorrow on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. Have a great day.